Last week, we, if you will, we generalized the ideas of state and dynamics. We had not just pure states described by state vectors, but we had mixed states, which might arise either from a mixture of pure states, probabilistic mixture of pure states, or from a larger system in an entangled state. We had this, and these were described by density operators. This gave us the power to describe a wider variety of quantum situations than before. And then we also generalized the notion of dynamics. We talked about the dynamics of an open system, a system interacting with its environment. And we found that we could describe that using either Krauss operators, or we could think about the unitary evolution of the larger system. And under a certain special approximation, the Markov approximation, where we assume that, if you will, at every moment, the system sees a fresh environment with which it is not effectively entangled at all, then we could actually describe something by a Lindblad kind of evolution. And we also made the argument at the end of our discussion that this kind of evolution that we described was the most general sort of evolution that could be described by a map on density operators. If you have a map on density operators describing the density operator at an earlier time evolves to a density operator at a later time, if you have such a map, then certain things have to be true about it. We argued based on an ensemble argument that it had to be a linear map on density operators, very different from a linear operator on state vectors, but a linear map on density operators, and it had to be trace-preserving, and it also had to be completely positive, which means that not only did the evolution map positive operators to positive operators, any extension of that evolution map to a larger system mapped positive operators to positive operators. Okay. And we found that anything that was a trace-preserving, completely positive linear map on density operators was describable by some Krauss operators or by unitary evolution on a larger system, even if it's one that we just made up. So we sort of got it squared away. We sort of know what the most general kind of dynamics that makes sense. Of course, there might be... it might be, for example, that a system is already entangled with its environment at some stage, and so it won't be good enough to describe its subsequent evolution by such a map, because not only does the future evolution depend on what the subsystem state is, but also how the subsystem is entangled with the larger system. That's perhaps true, but whenever we can make sense out of the evolution of the system in itself, it has to be something like this. Okay, so the first thing I want to do today is to generalize the notion of measurement. Now you remember sort of a kind of measurement we're all familiar with, what we might call a basic measurement. Okay, and the idea is we have a basis corresponding to the various possible outcomes of a measurement, and the probability of getting the outcome in is just the we'll think about it for a pure state at the moment, is just the magnitude squared of the inner product of n with the state vector. But of course, that's equal to n psi times its complex conjugate, psi n. And we recognize that as being actually a trace of the product of two operators. We can write that as the trace of rho times what we'll call pi sub n, where rho, of course, is the density operator describing our pure state, and pi n is the projection operator onto the nth eigenstate. So this is the the way I want to write this. And in fact, this generalizes. It generalizes for a mixed state as well. If the state is not a state vector psi, but it's a mixture of state vectors, that's perfectly all right. You just get the mixed state density operator here. And it also generalizes to situations where we have a measurement of an observable with degeneracy. With degeneracy. Degeneracy would mean that this projection is not merely the projection onto this state, but is a projection onto the whole subspace with a particular eigenvalue. But in both these generalizations don't change the form of this formula, that the probability of the outcome n is equal to the trace of rho times a projection associated with that measurement outcome. All right, so that's what we have for sort of the kind of measurement that we're all familiar with. What could this be in general? What could this be in general? And I'm going to ask the very general question. So here we go, in general. Let me carry my paper around with me if I might. In general, there's going to be some, we'll write it this way. There's going to be some function, okay? And this is the result of the measurement, the outcome of the measurement procedure, the reading on the dial of the machine. And this is the state of the system described by a density operator. And I don't know what this function is a priori. I just said there is some function like this. If you tell me the quantum state, I can calculate the probability of the measurement result. And let's find out what properties that function should satisfy. And we're going to make an argument just like we did before. It's an ensemble picture. Let's suppose that we imagine an ensemble of systems similarly prepared, and this one's in row 0, and this one's in row 1, and this one's in row 0, and this one's in row 1, and this one's in row 0, okay? All right? Got an ensemble here of systems. Each dot represents a system. The different systems are prepared in different states with different frequencies in the large box full of systems that is my ensemble. And this box full of systems is described overall by the mixed state, which is the mixture, the probabilistic mixture of the two density operators describing the states I've written here. Okay, and now I make a measurement on each one of these systems. Or if you will, I draw systems at random and make measurements. But what is that going to do? What's that going to do? Well, what's the probability that I'll get, the result A, if it's a row zero? Well, then that'll be P A given rho zero, and that'll be for this one. Actually, I need a bigger box. That's always the danger. Okay, I need a bigger box, or it might. So that's one possible measurement. That's one probability. If you happen to have picked this system, you'll wind up with this probability of getting the result A. If you happen to pick the next system, which is in row 1, probably you get the probability of A given row 1. That's a possible result. And then there's the probability of A given row 0 again, because that system over there in the upper right-hand corner, that's in row 0, and so on. So if I know which system I picked from the ensemble, I would know what the probability would be of getting result A. So the overall probability will simply be the probability that I pick one of these guys times this probability, plus the probability that I pick one of these guys times this probability. That is to say, the result, which is, of course, the probability of A given rho, because this ensemble is a way of describing what I mean by the state rho, that's going to be P1 times probability of A given rho 1 plus P2 times the probability of A given rho 2. What does this tell me? Oh, here it is. The first question of a Monday morning. What does this tell me? Right, hey, this tells me that this P function is linear in the density operator. That if I have the linear combination of density operators here, I get the linear combination of P's. So, therefore, P A rho is a linear function. A linear functional, in fact, on rho. It's a linear functional. A functional, of course, maps you to a scalar. The scalars here are numbers, probabilities. It's a linear functional. Okay? All right. So what does that mean? Well, remember, the rows are elements of a Hilbert space. The Hilbert space of operators on the underlying Hilbert space, which has an inner product. The Hilbert space has an inner product. AB equals the trace of A dagger B. Okay? What does that mean? That means any linear functional on that space can be written as an inner product on that space. Any linear functional can be written as an inner product. Any linear functional on a Hilbert space, any linear functional on Ketz, is a bra. Okay? It has to be. And so there must exist an operator E sub A such that the probability of A given the state rho is simply equal to the trace. And I'll write it in this order, rho E sub A. There must exist such an operator. It follows from the fact that this is a linear functional on density operators. And that follows from the fact that of the ensemble picture. Okay? Okay, that's pretty cool. Okay? We now know that the measurement probability rule we have is really the most general form we could have, except these guys here are E sub A's, and I don't know what they are, but they're some operators. Okay, so let me just write that up here because that's really handy. Okay, now, what can we say about these operators? What can we say about that? Well, let's suppose that rho is some pure state. Then this probability of A given rho, if you will, is this trace, but of course that trace is just the inner product of psi with EA psi. And since that's a probability, it has to be real and non-negative. This must be real and greater than or equal to zero. To be a probability, it had better be real and greater than or equal to zero. We don't have imaginary probabilities. We don't have negative probabilities. because this is actually probability of some actual result. Okay, this is something we actually see. This is something we can estimate by experiment, so it's got to be positive. Okay, and if that's true for any psi, that means that EA must be a positive operator. Must be a positive operator. Okay? All right. And finally, what if I add up all the probabilities over A of P of over all the different possible outcomes of this? What if I added up all of the probabilities? What should I get? I should get 1. And I should get 1 no matter what the state is. The probability that something happens is 1. Okay, and so what's this? Well, let's see. That's equal to the sum over A of the, well, I'll write it this way, psi EA psi, which is equal to psi sum over A of the E sub A's psi. And this is true for any psi which is normalized, a physical state. Any psi which is normalized will make this equal to 1. So what can I say about this operator inside? It has to be the identity, right? So therefore, I'm going to write this up here because it's also useful. No, I'll just write it down here. The sum of these guys is the identity. All right, sum over these guys is the identity. And so this is the most general kind of measurement that makes sense. The most general kind of measurement that makes sense is represented by a set of operators. These operators E. And what are these operators called? They're sometimes called effect operators. A term that goes back to some work in the 70s and 80s at putting quantum mechanics on an axiomatic basis in various ways. Effect operators. These effect operators, there's one for every measurement outcome. And what do I know about them? I know that they are positive, and I know that they must sum to 1 for the identity. And so this kind of generalized measurement is sometimes called a generalized measurement, sometimes called a positive operator measurement, or POM. POM. And sometimes, in somewhat more old-fashioned language, a positive operator-valued measure, or POVM. These days, most people would call it that. And this is the most general kind of measurement procedure there could be. Yeah? No.
Yeah, no, yes, they do. Sorry. Of course they do. The reason I said no, you'll see in a moment. But yes, they do. A positive operator is remission. That comes from the fact that this interferon is real. Positive operator is a subspecies of permission. But
as you see, they might be related to some non-hermitian operators in an interesting way. Okay. So this is true for anything that you want to call a measurement. In fact, this is true for any kind of box where you toss in a state and the light turns on and one light or the other turns on based on whatever happens inside. It might have random numbers inside. It might have complicated computations. It might have wild measurements on systems that are larger, that include the other one as a subsystem but have other things involved. No matter what, this is the most general kind of measurement procedure. Now, so there's a connection between what we did before and this. And so let me just show you that connection, or at least suggest that connection. I'm not going to give you the most general picture. But remember our discussion of open system dynamics. So we had an open system Q. System Q, and along with that we had an environment. E, which is initially in a fixed state, 0, and there's some interaction. There's some interaction which we represented by U, and then there was an E basis that we used to take. The partial trace over E. And what we found was that the unitary, after the evolution of U with psi 0, so this is psi for Q and 0 for E, that was maybe some entangled state. And I'll write the entangled state this way, which is really the way we did it. The sum over K of the of what we might call psi K, tensor K, this is the basis of E states. And this psi sub k, we've done this half a dozen times already. This psi sub k is a vector for q, which is k u psi 0. It's the partial inner product here. It's the partial inner product. And if you're having a little trouble following this, go back in and put superscripts to say what things follow, what things are, systems, refer to what systems. That refers to both systems, system Q, system E, system Q, system E, system Q, E, Q and E, Q, E. And of course, this was actually how we defined the Krauss operator A sub K acting on psi. Because this is a linear, it's a vector which linearly depends on psi. So it defines an operator. And then what we did is we took the partial trace over the environment. But now let's do something else. Let's measure the environment. Let's measure the environment using the basic measurement in the K basis. So let's measure E with a basic measurement, nothing fancy, using the K basis. Think about what this means. The environment here now is to be thought of as a probe. What we've done is we've got our quantum system Q, and we put the environment next to it, the environment, the E. We put the system E next to it, okay? And we let them interact for a moment, and now we're going to see what the system E is. E is now this external probe that we use to find out something about Q. All right? I think of it as, this is my STM tip that I'm putting next to my atom or something. All right. So what is the probability that I'll get the result K? Well, we've done this very analysis before. We've done this very analysis before because we've talked about what happens when we make a measurement on one part of an entangled system. The probability of the result K is just this thing, inner product with itself. Because remember, this is a subnormalized state. It's the conditional state for getting this measurement outcome. Subnormalized because it's got the probabilities kind of built into it. Okay? Okay, well, what's this? Well, this is, of course, psi ak dagger ak psi, which is indeed equal to the trace of rho times E sub k, where the E sub k is equal to ak dagger ak. So our Krauss operators, the Krauss operators that we would use to describe this open system evolution, are related to the effect operators that we would get from using this scheme as an indirect measurement of Q. In this way, you see that the Krauss operators, I said, could be anything. But this combination of them is a positive operator. And the normalization condition on the Krauss operators is exactly the same as the normalization condition on the effect operators. Voila. Questions? Questions about this? Okay, so we have generalized states to mixed states. We have states which we've got represented by density operators, rho. We've got dynamics. We generalize that to open system dynamics, which we can represent by trace preserving completely positive linear maps. Just CP is the E. And we've got also measurements. We've generalized the idea of measurements to include these positive operator measurements given by a set of effect operators. And that's sort of the general way of thinking about states and dynamics and measurements in quantum theory, including open systems and measurement procedures that include noise or indirect or anything. This is a general framework. And we showed in this case, and we waved our hands in this case, that under very modest reasonableness assumptions, you wind up with something like this. So pretty much the only game in town. All right. By the way, this is the necessary equipment for open system quantum mechanics. All right. I want to change course here, so I'm waiting for any last questions to percolate to the surface. All right. If we can talk about open systems, systems interacting with other systems, then we really have what we need to think about the subject of thermodynamics. Okay? Now, I'm only going to say a little bit about thermodynamics, just whatever I can say today. It's, of course, obviously a tremendously important subject. And it's not a typical part of your average quantum theory course. But it turns out that we have a good toolbox for understanding some of the basic ideas in thermodynamics. Thermodynamics turns out to be about quantum systems, obviously, otherwise it wouldn't be about anything, about quantum systems that can exchange energy in various ways with their surroundings. Okay? That's what thermodynamics is about. So what I want to do is I want to just take a few minutes and give you a picture of all the thermodynamics that you already know in quantum mechanics form. Okay? All right? Not all the thermodynamics you already know, actually. I'll only get the first 1.5 laws. So in thermodynamics, I'm going to have a system, and it's going to be in a state, rho, which in general is a very mixed state. Because often in thermodynamics, I'm going to be talking about a system whose microstate is very far from known, a system which has a large number of microscopic degrees of freedom, and I only know a few macroscopic parameters about it. And also, the state has an internal Hamiltonian, which will allow me to calculate the energy of the system. But the two things I want to point out is that both of these might be changing. Might change with time. The internal state might change with time, both because there's internal Hamiltonian evolution and because the system may be interacting with other systems. And the Hamiltonian might change because there are all these external things like the container that the system's contained in, or the external magnetic field or something like this. There are all these external parameters which might be changing. So they might change the Hamiltonian. Okay? Now, when I talk about the energy of a system, of course, this system might not have a definite energy. So what I really mean, of course, is the average energy. The thermodynamic energy, E sub theta, is equal to the expectation value of the energy, which is equal to the trace of rho times H. That's what I mean. So how might that change? How might that change? What's the time derivative of that? The time derivative of E sub theta, which I'll call E sub theta dot. I got tired of writing derivatives in Leibniz notation and switched over to Newton notation. Okay. All right. Well, I want to point out that that's going to be the derivative of this with respect to time. There'll be two terms, right? This is just the trace of a product, right? There's going to be a term, which is the trace of rho dot times h, and there'll be a term which is the trace of rho times h dot. Both of these might be changing with time. Okay? Right? So that means over a time dt, the change in the thermodynamic energy of the system is equal to the trace of rho dot h dt plus the trace of rho h dot dt. And these two terms have special names. This one's the heat. In fact, we define dq equal to trace of rho dot h dt, and dw is defined to be minus sign is traditional, trace of rho h dot dt. And these are the heat input and work output of the system over this period of time. And the minus sign is traditional, so that we're talking about the work output rather than the work input on the system. Yeah?
What are the dashes for the days?
The dashes.
Sorry, at the front of you, the Q. When you use that notation.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you about that in a second. This is a small heat input, but it's not a small change in a Q function, which I'll explain in a minute. It's an inexact differential. Okay, an inexact differential. Okay, now think about what these mean. This is change in the energy of the system having to do not with the fact that Hamiltonian is changing. The Hamiltonian might be constant, but this is due to change in the quantum state of the system. This is change in the energy, not due to the change in the quantum state, but due to the fact that the Hamiltonian is changing. Why might the Hamiltonian be changing? Well, because of those external parameters, like the external magnetic field or the container that closes the system. Those things might be changing, and that will produce a change in the Hamiltonian. So this is change in energy associated with changes in those external parameters, and this is change in energy associated with change in the quantum state. And those are, in fact, heat and work. Okay, now suppose we go, and so that means, by the way, that dE theta is equal to dq minus dW, which is the first law of thermodynamics. But for us, that's just a definition of dq, and dE. It comes from this definition. We can define these things so that this is the case. Now I want to tell you a little bit about those D's with the slash through them. Okay, the inexact differentials. So let's suppose. Suppose we go from a certain state, rho sub A, with a certain Hamiltonian, rho sub A, to a new state, rho sub B, with a certain Hamiltonian, H sub B. Okay? Right, suppose we do this. Suppose we have this some process which
changes the state and the Hamiltonian and from one thing to another. Well then, the change in E sub theta is simply the final E sub theta minus the initial E sub theta. And that only depends on this beginning state and ending state. That only depends on the beginning situation and the ending situation. Sorry, the state. I really mean the situation, because I have to tell you not only rho, but also h. It only depends on the beginning situation and the ending situation. It doesn't depend on how you went from one to the other. Okay? It doesn't depend on the details of this arrow. So this is path independent. Now, this change is equal to the total heat minus the total work, where Q is equal to the integral going from A to B of dQ, and W is equal to the integral going from A to B of dW. But it turns out, and you'll actually work out something this afternoon, which will be an example of that, it turns out that these two are path dependent. These guys are path dependent in general. That going by one path, Q and W might be one thing, but going by another path, Q and W might be quite different. Their difference, of course, gives you delta E theta, which would be the same. But individually, they might be different. And that means, think about what that means. That means that that this integral is not just the difference between an initial and final anything. It's not a difference between an initial and final anything. Knowing the endpoints of the evolution, I can't tell you what this integral is. I need to know how you went from one end to the other. Okay? So the way of putting it is that dE theta is said to be an exact differential. And dQ and dW are inexact differentials. You may have seen that notation. It means, for example, that if you had a closed process where you started out in a certain situation and wound up in the same situation, the net change in the energy would be zero. But it wouldn't necessarily be the case that Q and W would be both zero for that process. They'd be equal, but they might be non-zero. We can't integrate these differentials into a global function. And non-integrability, boy, you see that all over the place, right? I mean, that's in everything from mechanics to curvature. Yeah?
That was my question.
People have done some metric things about this, but because these guys aren't really like vectors, what they're sort of like it's more like fiber bundles, and the work, for example, is given by a connection on a fiber bundle consisting of kind of an energy fiber over the manifold of the underlying thermodynamic state space, and the generalized forces, which are relate tiny displacements in the state space to the work, amount to a connection on this fiber bundle. And so you can do it that way. You can phrase things in the fiber bundle language if you're happy with fiber bundles. okay, But not exactly curvature, because, of course, in curvature, you're looking at the tangent bundle, which is where you have a tangent space at every point in your manifold. And the thing that you look at small changes of is maybe some vector that you drag by parallel transport around in the manifold. So this is my attempt to connect thermodynamics, which you all understand, to Riemannian geometry, which you all understand, right? So, okay, so all right. So having done all this, defined VQ and everything, and I'm going to write those up here because I'm going to be using those all the time. So a small change in Q is the trace of rho dot h dt, and the small dw, that's minus the trace of rho h dot dt. All right, there we go. Okay. I'm now going to consider a whole bunch of special cases. That's a sort of a useful way of getting I won't complete anything then. That's a useful way of getting understanding of what we're talking about. Okay, so a bunch of special cases. Let's consider Hamiltonian evolution. Okay? Hamiltonian evolution, that's our first special case. First special case number one. Hamiltonian evolution. And that means that rho dot is equal to 1 over I h bar times the commutator of h with rho. Remember, it appears in this order for the dynamics here. And just because it's Hamiltonian evolution doesn't mean the Hamiltonian is not itself changing. The Hamiltonian might be changing. I might be turning up or down the external field or something. But I'm assuming that the dynamics of the system are generated by the Hamiltonian at any given moment, which is the assumption that we said before, that this the system's informationally isolated or something like that. So let's see what happens now. So if rho dot's equal to that, let's look at the heat transfer to the system. Okay? All right. So dq is equal to, it's equal to, of course, trace rho dot h dt, which is equal to 1 over I h bar times the trace of h rho h dt. See where this is going? Which is equal to 1 over I h bar. Of course, this is the difference of two operators. So it's the difference of two traces. There's the trace of h rho h minus the trace of rho times h h. But what's that? It's zero. It's zero. Okay? It's zero because of the cyclic property of the trace. And therefore, there's no heat transfer. Hamiltonian evolution is thermally isolated evolution. Actually, thermally isolated is a more encompassing term, but Hamiltonian evolution is at least an example of thermally isolated evolution. Informationally isolated means you're thermally isolated, and that would mean, for example, that dW is equal to minus dE theta. It would mean that in fact the work is an exact differential. The work done by the system is the negative of the change in the system's energy, and that means that the E sub theta is a thermodynamic potential in this situation. A thermodynamic potential, the work done is simply equal to minus the change in the internal energy. If I know that the evolution is Hamiltonian evolution, I can just calculate the energy of the system at the beginning and the end, and that'll tell me how much work is done by the system. That's a when you are in a situation with a thermodynamic potential, you're happy because you can calculate the work done really easily. Okay, which is just like the potential in regular ordinary first grade mechanics. In certain situations, the work done by a force is just equal to the negative of the change of this function. The force is nice and integrable. This function is the potential energy function. Okay. Now, actually, the above analysis, this analysis will hold whenever the dQ is zero. Okay, whenever there's no contribution from the rho dot term, right? So here's another example of something like this. Let's suppose we have a sudden change in H. That is to say, it goes from HA to HB fast. A sudden change. What do I mean by fast? Rho has no time to, no time to evolve during this change. This change is so fast that the density operator describing rho can't catch up. Okay? Well, in that case, there's no heat change. There's in this finite change, Q equals zero, and the work done is simply minus the change in the thermodynamic energy, which is of course just the trace of rho times HA minus HB, the initial minus the final because of this minus sign, the initial minus the final. So that's a situation where you can now calculate the work done. If you just suddenly change the Hamiltonian, the system does work. The work done on the system, of course, is the negative of this, which is just the change in the system's energy. Oh, yeah. You're going to have to do work on the system to change the Hamiltonian? It all makes sense. To change the system's energy in this way? Yeah?
The notion that, transfer is usually a slow process. Is this basically what we're doing here?
Yes. If there are the idea being this is a sort of a simplified version of that. Basically, this is a way in which you can easily see that this wouldn't happen. But to argue that in a particular case, you'd have to know something about how rho dot is changing. So let's imagine, for example, let's suppose you have Lindblad evolution. And by the way, the Markov approximation for Lindblad evolution is a nice kind of assumption for thermodynamics. If your system is interacting with some thermal reservoir, you might say, well, what I mean by a thermal reservoir is a system whose properties are basically unchanged if I add a little heat or do a little interaction with the system. The system pretty much looks the same no matter how I interact with it. It's this gigantic reservoir of heat, for example, and taking a little bit of energy out of it doesn't change its temperature significantly. That assumption is like the Markov assumption that that I can just think of the environment as being unentangled or unaltered, perhaps, in any way by my interaction with it. So this is a kind of a nice thermodynamic sort of thing. And let's of course in that we have both a Hamiltonian part and also the Lindblad operator part, so rho, okay, dagger, minus 1/2 LK dagger LK anti-commutator with rho. Okay, great. Now, let's consider, once again,
dq, which is the trace of rho dot h times dt. Let's look at trace of rho dot h. Okay? Let's look at trace of rho dot h. Well, the first thing is that we already saw that the Hamiltonian part will contribute zero to this. The Hamiltonian part of the evolution will contribute nothing to this. Okay? So only the Lindblad operator parts will be related to heat transfer into the system. And so I can just write down that. I'm going to have write down those terms. I'm going to have the sum over k of the trace of LK rho LK dagger H minus the trace, oh sorry, minus 1/2 times the trace of LK dagger LK rho H minus 1/2 times the trace of rho LK dagger LK H. Okay, there we go. That'll be the rate at which heat is being transferred. The rate at which heat is being transferred. But now imagine, as a special case of this special case, imagine that H commutes with each one, H commutes with each one of the Lindblad operators, each one of these operators. What would that mean? Oh, and by the way, this also implies, of course, since H is a Hermitian, it also implies that this is zero, that H also commutes with LK dagger. It doesn't imply that LK and LK dagger commute with each other. They might not be normal. Well, what does this mean? What that would mean is that if I started out with an energy eigenstate, suppose I had some side work here, H in equals E sub n in. Let's consider the, so this is an energy eigenstate, let's consider H acting on LK of n. Well, since these commute, this is actually just E sub n times LK of n, which means that LK of n is equal to, well, it might be an eigenvector of H with the same energy, E sub n. It might be an eigenstate of H with the same energy. Or it might be zero. It might be zero. What that means is the LK operators are such that they cannot change the energy of a quantum state. If these LK operators represent processes that might happen, okay, processes that might happen, then if they all commute with a Hamiltonian, that means that whatever those processes are, they can't change the energy of the state. The LKs cannot take you from a state with one energy to a state with another energy. Yeah?
If LK annihilates the state, the energy becomes zero, right?
Oh, no. That's just that in this term, that means that you never get any contribution. That means the LKs, this is not a problem. Because we know that the LKs, if you sum up LK dagger LK, you get the, you know that you won't be changing the norm of this guy. You know, this guy's going to be trace zero. So you know nothing bad will happen to the thing. What this all this means is that some LKs might not be doing anything to that state. Right? Some of the LKs might apply only to some of the input states. And the net effect is that you don't get any contributions. You don't get any contributions from states with different energies. And so, in that case, if that's true, you can really easily see by the cyclic property of the trace, I can commute. I can bring this LK to the end. I can commute it with H, and I get rho LK dagger LK H, which is the same as rho LK dagger LK H here. And this guy, I can move L. I can move this guy to the end and commute it with the H because both of these guys are commuting the H. All of these guys are the same.
And so the moral of the story is that in this special case, where the LKs commute with the Hamiltonian, then the trace of rho dot H is equal to zero, which means that no heat is transferred. So the only way that heat can be transferred here is if you've got some of these LK operators, which can cause changes. If you apply them to a state, you can jump from one energy to another energy of the system. The interaction with the environment is such that it can change your energy. That's the only way that heat can be transferred. Okay, so that makes sense. Everything I say, you're going to wind up at the end saying, well, yeah, I knew that. Well, of course you knew that. But now I can show you where it comes from the formalism. That's the purpose of the lecture today. let's do another one. Another simple special case. And then we'll do a more complicated one, which is more interesting. Okay. Suppose H is constant. That means that there's no work done. And that means that dQ is actually just dE theta. It's exact. And the heat transfer in any given process is just the change in the energy, which is just equal to the trace of the final state minus the initial state times H. There you go. There's that. That'd be a situation where you're holding all the external parameters that determine H fixed. Okay. For our finale for thermodynamics here, or for these special cases, let's consider an isothermal process. An isothermal process. What is an isothermal process? Yes, that's right. That's right. It's got a constant temperature. Which means that basically what this means for us is that H changes slowly, relatively slowly, and because at any moment the state is equal to a thermal state, 1 over Z e to the minus beta H, where beta, which is 1 over Boltzmann's constant times T, is constant. H might be changing, but beta stays the same, and you're always in exactly this state. And Z, of course, is a partition function, which is the trace of e to the minus I, or sorry, e to the minus I, no I's, e to the minus beta H. Okay, so I want to consider how things change in this case. And so I'm going to be taking the derivative with respect to time of this guy. Yes?
Are we just assuming this, or does that actually follow from
the fact that it's... No, it doesn't follow from this fact. But what I'm assuming is that the interaction with the environment is such that that environment causes the state to approach the thermal equilibrium state. And that process of approaching thermal equilibrium is faster than the changes in H. So that's the assumption I'm making. So this is all part of the assumption. Okay? all part of the assumption. The age changes slowly is actually a motivation for this. I imagine that there's not only this internal dynamic age, there's also some sort of relaxation process leading me toward thermal equilibrium. Okay, good. All right, so I need a mathematical aside, though. Okay, aside. All right.
Suppose that's abbreviation for suppose. Suppose A depends on time. What is the derivative with respect to time of f of A? That's what I want to know. And you know, you might be really tempted to say that was the derivative of f times A dot. You might be tempted to say that. But it's not true in general. It's not true. Let me give you an example. Let's suppose f of A is equal to A cubed. Of course, I'm going to define A as a power series, so something like this is always worthwhile. All right, A times A times A. Now let's take the derivative of f. Okay, well, I've got the product of three A's, so I'm going to have the product rule with three terms. There's going to be A dot times AA. There's going to be AA dot A. And there's going to be AAA dot. And that's not equal to 3A squared A dot in general. Why? Because A dot does not necessarily commute with A. So that's kind of annoying. Okay? It's kind of annoying. However, there's something which is so. These guys aren't equal to each other, but they're cyclic permutations of each other. So if I were to take the trace of this, then the trace of that would be equal to the trace of that, because all these things would be put together. I could cyclically permute the A dot to the end on each one. So it is true that the derivative with respect to time of the trace of any function of A, because I could do this for any term in a power series, is equal to the trace of F prime of A dot. It's true for the trace. The trace makes it okay. But it's not true as an operator relationship. And the reason is that A dot might not commute with A. By the way, it is entirely possible that you'll come across somebody who gets this wrong. Be kind, but firm. Okay, so, all right. So this is true. This is a really handy thing. So let's see. We've got all these things. Let's find out what z dot is. Z dot. That's the derivative with respect to time of the trace of e to the minus beta h. And that's nice because, right? See why that's nice? Everybody see why that's nice? Right, because I can take that derivative nicely using my trace rule. I can't necessarily tell you the derivative of this thing very nicely, but I can tell you the derivative of the trace very nicely. That's equal to the trace of minus beta h dot times e to the minus beta h, which I can write as minus beta times the trace of h dot e to the minus beta h. I put the derivative in front because I just cyclically permuted it around to the front. It's a trace. Okay. Everybody happy with that? The reason I did that is because if I then look at the amount of work done during the isothermal process, that being, of course, minus the trace of rho dot h times dt, rho h dot. Whew, I'm talking about work, not heat. Rho h dot. Ah, well, that's going to be equal to, since I know what, that rho is equal to rho theta at any given time, that's going to be equal to minus 1 over z times the trace of e to the minus beta h times h dot. Oh, but I recognize that guy. I recognize that guy from z dot. That's just minus z dot over beta. And so I get 1 over beta times z dot. That's dw. Of course, all times dt. Oh, but look. What's that? That's equal to 1 over beta times the derivative with respect to time of the log of z. Times dt. So we're going to define a new quantity called the free energy. Isn't this great? So define the free energy, the Helmholtz free energy, of course, the free energy f theta, which is equal to minus 1 over beta times the log of z. It's only defined for thermal states. It's only defined for thermal states right now. Maybe we can do better later. Which is, of course, minus kt log of z. And then dw is equal to minus df. This is only for thermal equilibrium states. And so then dw is equal to df. F sub theta is a potential, a thermodynamic potential. And therefore, for an isothermal process, the work done is minus the change in the free energy, which I can easily calculate. All I have to calculate is minus kt log z for the beginning and ending states. So, for an isothermal process, it makes sense to define f theta and work things out this way. Okay, I hope I've begun to explain to you why the open system stuff that we've had really lets us think about thermodynamics for quantum systems in a very systematic way. We can define things in terms of what's going on with the density operator and so on, and we can arrive at all kinds of nice pieces. I'm not going to erase this yet. Okay, so now I want to move on to talk about that other piece of thermodynamics that I haven't mentioned yet, which is entropy. Very good. Entropy. And indeed, in entropy, there's a classical idea of entropy, and there's a quantum mechanical idea of entropy. And so let me sort of talk about them in parallel. So over here, I'm going to put classical entropy, and over here, I'm going to put quantum entropy. And I'm just going to sort of develop them in parallel. And the first classical idea of entropy is the Boltzmann idea. The Boltzmann idea, and this is where you have W different accessible microstates. That is to say, W states that are all equally likely, but those are the only ones that are possible. And then you get Boltzmann's formula, which is that the entropy, and entropy I'm going to write S sub theta, S sub theta is equal to K times the log of W. That's Boltzmann's formula. That's on Boltzmann's tomb, pretty close. He wrote log instead of ln. But I guess he didn't write it. They wrote log instead of ln. Okay, so this is the Boltzmann idea. And the corresponding thing in quantum mechanics is a situation where you might have the density operator is uniform on an accessible subspace of states. That is to say, rho is equal to 1 over d times the projection onto that subspace, where d is the dimension of our accessible subspace. Accessible subspace S of states. So if rho has got this form, so it's like the identity on that subspace is zero elsewhere, and it's normalized. It's completely mixed. It's like the center point of the block ball on that subspace, but it's a zero outside that subspace in some sense. This is the projection onto my subspace S. Well, in this case, there's a corresponding formula that S sub theta is equal to, in fact, k times the log of the dimension of the subspace. And you see that they're perfectly analogous, except to count subspaces, you actually count Hilbert space dimensions. I mean, to count states, you count Hilbert space dimensions. There are actually an infinite number of states in that subspace, right? If it's just two-dimensional, there's this state, there's that state, there's all the superpositions of them. The proper way to count them is to count the dimension of the subspace. Well, in fact, this was generalized by Gibbs, where you say if you have the state alpha with the probability p alpha, then the entropy, according to Gibbs, is minus k times the sum over alpha of p alpha log p alpha. That's the right generalization if you have a bunch of states. For example, in a thermal equilibrium state, the states aren't equally likely, and so this allows you to calculate the entropy in that situation. And when there are W equally likely states and all the rest of them have zero probability, this formula actually reduces to that formula. The corresponding thing, quantum mechanically, was written down by von Neumann back in the 30s, early 30s. Yeah?
There is a minus sign at the front here.
Yes, because the log of a probability is always going to be negative. And so this had better be a positive thing. But this is a plus sign because it's the log not of the probability, which would be 1 over W, but the log of W, which is the negative of the log of 1 over W. Right. So here we just have von Neumann said that if you have a general state described by a density operator, then you can write down an entropy for it. It's minus k times the trace of rho log rho. It's actually very cute. Because you don't have to think of rho as being composed of some particular mixture of states. It's just a functional of rho itself, not a linear functional, a nonlinear functional of rho itself. You give me the density operator, I can calculate its entropy. If you later want to tell me your recipe for making that density operator from entangled states or from a mixture, that's fine. But the entropy is this. Yeah.
For a pure state. So think about what that is. If I do this sum in the diagonal, if I do this trace in the basis which makes rho diagonal, then I'll get exactly this sum for the eigenvalues of rho. Okay?
Well, now, the eigenvalues for a pure state are all 0 except one of them's 1. Well, what do I get when I get 0 in this term? What's 0 log 0? Well, that's actually kind of tricky, but you realize that epsilon log epsilon approaches 0 as epsilon approaches 0, because the log diverges, but not very fast. So we take 0 log 0 to mean 0 in that sum. And all those terms go to 0. The other one is 1 log 1, but log of 1 is 0, so that's 0 too. So this sum is 0 if one probability is 1 and the others are all 0. And this is 0. S theta is equal to 0 for rho equal to a pure state. Pure states have 0 entropy. Finally, I'm not going to talk much about this, but this is terribly important these days. There's a connection between the entropy and information. And this was due to Shannon in the 1940s. And if you have a message n that occurs with probability p of n, then the information content of the message, which we'll call h, is just minus the sum over n of p of n log base 2 of p of n, which you can see is up to a constant, just our old friend the entropy. In fact, when Shannon realized that this was a measure of information content, he was trying to figure out what to call it. And the story is that von Neumann told him to call it the entropy because it is up to a constant, the same as Gibbs' expression. And nobody knew what entropy was, so nobody could object. So that's where this comes from. And there's a similar thing in quantum mechanics. And I don't want to so because there are different concepts of rho arises either from an unknown, it might be that there's some unknown state, phi sub alpha with probability p sub alpha, that is to say, these states represent, say, a physical signal of some kind, and then that leads to a density operator, or there might be some entanglement. And the state is in a mixed state because the system is entangled with another system. And in either case, we can think of that as a kind of quantum information. And the correct quantum mechanical expression is given by minus the trace of rho log base 2 of rho. Why log base 2? Well, that's so that in the classical information, information comes out in bits. Information is actually related to the number of binary digits you need to represent a message. And here, this means that the information comes out in qubits. You actually get a number which has some significance in how many qubit systems you need to faithfully represent the signal. And so this is a connection. I mention this because it's really important, but not because I'm going to do anything with it. We're going to stick with the middle line here. Yeah?
Yeah,
you last of the first. You mean these two?
Yeah.
Well, right. I mean, if you had w possible messages that were all equally likely, then this would give you the log of w, log base 2 of w. So if you have 8 possible messages, that's 3 bits. Okay. All right. So now I want to talk mostly about the thermodynamic significance of this, and so let me consider this stuff in the middle. In fact, I'm really most interested in this because I'm thinking about thermodynamics today. Okay, let's consider a thermal state. rho sub theta is equal to 1 over z e to the minus beta h. And I know what z is. So let's try to work out what the entropy is. Well, in order to do that, I'm going to have to take the logarithm of rho. What is the log of rho? Well, it's not hard to work out. I have to work it out in the, it's not hard to work out if I pick the basis in which this is diagonal, the energy basis. And you can sort of see how it's going to work. It's going to work that that I get minus the log of z times the identity operator minus beta times h. Sort of see that the log applied to that operator might give you that, and it does. Okay? And in that case, since we're hurrying through this, the entropy, which is minus the Boltzmann's constant times the trace of rho theta log theta, will be equal to minus, well, see, equal to Boltzmann's constant times the log of z times the trace of rho theta times 1 plus beta times the trace of rho theta times h. Oh, yeah? Well, that's easy to work out. I get k log of z plus beta times e sub theta, the thermodynamic energy, the average energy. And we can recognize some cool things about this. Oh, sorry, k beta. K times beta is equal to 1 over t. And k log z we recognize as the free energy divided by t with a minus sign. And so that actually lets us work out a relationship between the free energy, the entropy, and the temperature, which is that the free energy is equal to the energy minus T times the entropy. Now, why do I care about that? I care about that because previously I could only write down the free energy for something that was in a thermal state. Because it was written in terms of Z. Z is only defined for a thermal state. But this guy is defined for any state. I just need a density operator, a Hamiltonian, and a temperature. And the density operator does not have to be the thermal density operator. So I can define it this way for any state. F theta is a function of the state, the Hamiltonian, and the temperature of a thermal reservoir. There has to be a temperature somewhere. So imagine there's some thermal reservoir out there. And then we can do all kinds of good stuff with that. Okay, now we'll be fine. As rho changes, so does the entropy. So what is the rate of change of the entropy? Well, that's equal to minus k times the derivative with respect to time of the trace of rho log rho. Okay? Ah, good. I've got the time derivative of the trace. And so it's the time derivative of the trace, so I can use the simple rule. And the derivative of rho log rho with respect to rho will be, the derivative of x log x is log x minus, or log x plus 1. Right, so I get minus k times the trace of log rho plus 1 times rho dot. Oh, but remember, what's the trace of rho dot? Zero, yes, because rho doesn't change its normalization. And so this is just equal to S sub theta is equal to dot, S sub theta dot is equal to minus k times the trace of rho dot log rho, which is a very handy little formula. Now, okay, I'm going to erase. Now, let me just tell you about one more special case, one more special process, okay? One more special kind of process, and then we're done for the day. And that's a so-called quasi-static process. A quasi-static process. And in a quasi-static process, rho is equal to the equilibrium state, the thermal equilibrium state, at all times. That's like an isothermal process, right? But both H and T may be changing. So the temperature of the thing may be altering during your quasi-static process. But at any given time, we're making the assumption that it's in a thermal equilibrium state. And we might imagine that there are some processes that cause you to go to thermal equilibrium. All these other things that are changing change slowly compared to those processes. Okay? And so now let's look at how S dot changes. Let's look at S dot. Well, that's going to be minus K, as we just wrote over there, times the trace of rho sub theta dot times the log of rho sub theta. But we wrote down the log of rho sub theta over here. That's going to be useful. That's going to be K times, let's see, there's going to be two terms. One of them is going to be the log of Z times the trace of rho theta dot. And the other one's going to be, okay, we're going to have beta times the trace of rho dot times H. That's what we get. The minus sign goes away, of course, because of these minus signs. And this is what we get from our calculation. What's the trace of rho theta dot? Zero. And we get K beta times the trace of rho dot H. But what is rho dot H related to? It's related to Q, right? DQ, oh, what an exciting lecture. Chalk is exploding everywhere. DQ is equal to the trace of rho dot H dt. That's almost the first thing we wrote. And this is just 1 over T. We wrote that over there. So the moral of the story is that a small change in S, and that's an exact differential because S just depends on what your state is, which is, of course, equal to, this is, of course, equal to S dot dt, that change in S is equal to dq divided by t. You may have seen that before. But it's a consequence of our definition of entropy that in a quasi-static process, a process in which temperature and the internal energy function may be changing, but it changes slowly enough that some sort of relaxation processes always keep you arbitrarily close to the equilibrium state, that in a quasi-static process, the change in the entropy is simply related to the heat input of the system. Okay, a lot of the things we talked about today probably seem really familiar, right? Yeah. But we've now derived them from a couple of definitions and from our understanding of how open quantum systems behave. And I think this is a connection that's not often enough made. It's a very pretty connection, and I'm done with it after I answer questions. Say louder.
Are you assuming I don't have any motion?
No. I'm not. No, I'm not. In fact, that wouldn't be the case. But Hamiltonian evolution will not contribute to the heat transfer anyway. The Hamiltonian part of the evolution is only would contribute to the work. I'm in fact assuming otherwise. Because as the temperature changes, the rho will have to somehow undergo some relaxation processes to relax it toward the thermal equilibrium for that given H and temperature at any given time. So I'm not at all assuming Hamiltonian evolution. Why do you think so?
So shouldn't we have done with the trace of rho because it's not?
No. Because I got this not by starting out by looking at how the energy changes over time, but by looking at how the entropy changes, which I worked out in general. Or any, this is a general thing from any kind of change in rho. This tells you how that translates into a change in S. And so this is the change in S. And from that I just worked it out to here. There's not an additional term. I'm not making any assumptions about the time evolution, except that at any given time, if I just took a snapshot, for whatever the instantaneous Hamiltonian temperature might be, the state is in an equilibrium state. That's the only thing I'm assuming. In general, Hamiltonian evolution won't do that. Yes?
So the rho theta here is e to the minus beta h, but beta in h depends on time?
Exactly. Right. Both of these guys might be depending on time, therefore this too. Right. But the H is indeed the system of Hamiltonian. So that's a real assumption. I can't define that away by some redefinition of it. Okay, sorry to keep you long. That's it for today. And see you tomorrow. Actually, see you this afternoon, probably.
Is there a measure of information content?